the way we feel we want to have sex or what works for us versus how we feel we're supposed to have sex. And then that can create a lot of shame. For example, men are just supposed to show up with erections and they're supposed to be always on and always instantly arousable, or women should be able to experience spontaneous desire just the way a man does and want to like throw a guy against the bed sometimes the way a man might want to throw his female partner against the bed. And so a lot of us, I think, end up or we have some kind of a kink or sexual interest that we feel might be deviant, or we like to watch porn and our cultural background tells us that that's sinful or addictive. So I think very much the ways in which we have sex, our personal sex scripts, are really informed by the cultural sex scripts. And it's very easy to feel like you're broken through that lens.
Hey there, friends. Welcome back to the Happy Habit Podcast. I'm Matthew. I'm here Mondays and Thursdays talking all things health and well-being. Almost 360 episodes in the archive. So many great episodes, discussions and interviews for you to check out. And I've got an interview lined up for you today, which I think will pique your interest because the topic at hand is that of sex. Yes, Dr. Ian Kerner is a practicing sex therapist and author of the best-selling She Comes First. In this episode, Dr. Kerner helps dispel some commonly held misconceptions about sex. We learn that desire, or should I say a lack thereof, is largely the reason many people choose to see a sex therapist. We hear about the assurances that many women need in order to feel comfortable during sex, especially when receiving oral sex. Expect to learn how premature ejaculation can be treated. I ask what role pornography can play in a healthy sexual relationship. We learn that the majority of people are bored with their sex lives and women are twice as likely to be bored after the first year with their partner. Plus, we discover how to meet our partner's sexual needs in the bedroom. I know that you've been working in the field of sex therapy for many years now. You've been described as the Sherlock Holmes of the bedroom, so I presume you're great at seeking out clues and finding solutions. I'm just curious, what are the main sex-related issues that people see you about?
Well, I see a mix of individuals and couples. Large percentage are heterosexual. Another percentage is usually gay men and LGBTQ. And I would say that the most common issue that everyone comes to see me for is usually some kind of desire issue, a desire discrepancy. One partner wants sex more than the other. Both partners can't find their way back to sex or never really had much sex to begin with and are starting to feel frustrated. But I would usually say that It's around getting sex going and initiating, experiencing desire. Now, then, of course, couples also come in with problems, not necessarily around desire, but around the sex that they're actually having. And it wouldn't be uncommon for men to come in with performance anxiety and sexual function issues, such as erectile unpredictability or early ejaculation. It would not be uncommon for women to come in complaining about sexual pain or a lack of arousal or sex that isn't pleasurable enough to lead to orgasm, or just a general inability to get immersed in a sexual event. And then I would say the other most common area would just be kind of a mismatch in erotic personalities or sexual personalities. One partner may be a little more of a thrill seeker than the other partner, or want to take sex out of the bedroom or open up the relationship in some way. And the other partner, is much more of a sexual homebody, so to speak.
And are there many common misconceptions that people still have today about the role of sex therapy?
I think that a lot of people think that sex should be natural, organic, and spontaneous, and you shouldn't need to go to therapy for sex. You shouldn't need sex homework. You shouldn't need to either schedule time to talk about sex or to have sex, sex is something that should just either work or it doesn't work. And if it doesn't work, something's wrong and can't really be managed. It's very odd that couples are really willing to dig in and work on almost any topic, but yet they really do feel that sex is something that you should never have to talk about and should just come naturally.
Well, does that lead then to people feeling as if there's something broken inside them then, if when it comes to something as fundamental as sex, there's a problem?
Well, I think a lot of people feel broken around their sexuality. And I think a lot of people are living lives of silent desperation when it comes to sex. And they're lying right next to somebody and they can talk about any subject under the sun except sex. And, you know, in one of my books, I talk a lot about our sex scripts, literally the way a sexual event looks from beginning to end and the sequence of behaviors that we engage in, very much like a movie script. And what I really talk about in one chapter is how our personal sex scripts are really formed in the context of cultural sex scripts. And there's usually some kind of incongruence between the way we feel we want to have sex or what works for us versus how we feel we're supposed to have sex. And then that can create a lot of shame. For example, men are just supposed to show up with erections and are supposed to be always on and always instantly arousable. Or women should be able to experience spontaneous desire just the way a man does, and want to like throw a guy against the bed sometimes the way a man might want to throw his female partner against the bed. And so a lot of us, I think, end up, or we have some kind of a kink or sexual interest that we feel might be deviant, or we like to watch porn and our cultural background tells us that that's, sinful or addictive. So I think very much the ways in which we have sex, our personal sex scripts, are really informed by the cultural sex scripts. And it's very easy to feel like you're broken through that lens.
Well, how do those cultural and social mores then interplay then with pornography? You mentioned it there. Does pornography more often than not help or hinder a couple's sexual relationship?
I look at pornography in a somewhat neutral way. And if I had to go in one direction versus the other, I would say that pornography, and when I'm talking about pornography, I like to talk about ethical porn, which is just a kind of porn that you pay something for, but it's sort of like fair trade coffee, it's just made with higher standards. And I think many couples get bored in their sex lives and they start to lack a kind of psychological arousal that they don't necessarily know how to create together. They don't know how to necessarily share a fantasy, but they need some kind of psychological jumpstart. And I think in those cases, porn can be very useful. Visual stimuli can be very arousing. And so it can help create what I call an arousal runway. So I think in many cases, porn can be part of a sex script and part of a way in which a couple gets going, and it's completely healthy. But I think in some cases, porn can also be polarizing, particularly if one partner is threatened by it, if we have different values around it, if we are turning to porn instead of dealing with a sexual problem that may exist within our relationship, or if we start to use porn as some kind of outlet or coping mechanism and we rely too heavily on it. But on the whole, as a society or as a culture, I think we are much too alarmist around porn and are quick to label, at least here in this country, a sort of a national health crisis. And I really think that that's really has more to do with cultural politics than the reality of how sexual material comes up in our lives.
You performed a study in boredom in the bedroom, sexual boredom. What were your findings in that study?
Yeah, I did that. It's been about 10 years, so it's a little bit of an older study. I did it with Dr. Kristen Mark, and we just wanted to research the idea to which couples may be bored in their sex lives. And as I recall, we interviewed gave a survey to a little over 5,000 people about mixed demographics, and I believe 55%. Were either extremely bored or somewhat bored in their sex lives. And women were twice as likely to be bored in the first year of a marriage as opposed to men. So women got bored sooner than men in their relationships. And women were, I believe, 2 to 3 times more likely to propose a sexy suggestion to deal with boredom. So I mean, I think on the whole, we're finding that people do get bored in their sex lives. In heterosexual couples, it's often women who get bored first, but it's also women who can be proactive about wanting to spice things up and make sex more novel.
And being proactive is key here, because I believe you're not a fan of spontaneity.
I'm a fan of spontaneity when it happens, and I think spontaneity is something that needs to be nurtured. You know, in most of our busy lives, I'm married with 2 kids and dealing with so many issues, spontaneity is less likely to happen. Now, that doesn't mean I have to go out and plan every sexual event, but it does mean that I need to at least cultivate a sexual environment in which sexual urges and feelings can manifest spontaneously. So I'm not opposed to scheduling sex. I'm not opposed to having a date night that's going to include sex. There are studies that show that couples who have sex once a week have higher levels of relationship positivity as opposed to couples who don't have sex once a week. In that sense, I'm very much in favor of sex being a ritual, if need be, that you schedule, like you would schedule any other kind of ritual in your life, like a family dinner every Sunday night. But that said, I'm more in favor of actually just creating what I call the erotic thread, or the space in between sexual events, where our sexual selves can come out and say hi to each other, even briefly. And so sex somehow remains in the environment, in the air. We know that we are wanted and desired by our partners. And then that allows for the spontaneity that so many of us seem to want so desperately.
So there's always an undercurrent of sex and sexuality in the air. It's not like we put something away and then take it out again once a week or once a month. It's always in the air.
Absolutely. It's about being flirtatious. It's flirtatious. It's about letting your partner know you desire them. You know, it's about a healthy objectification. And listen, that can happen when a partner's coming out of the shower, or someone's getting dressed for work and looks great, or you had a sexual dream, or you just thought about sex for some reason. If you can bring that to your partner and share that, then I think you're keeping sex in the air.
If we can talk about the female orgasm in your book, She Comes First, you talk about the assurances that women need in order to feel comfortable enough with their partners so that they can achieve orgasm. Can you tell us what those assurances look like?
Well, in She Comes First, you know, I was talking overall about helping men get clitorate, so to speak, and understanding that the clitoris is the powerhouse of the female orgasm, not the vagina, and that the vulva and most of the sensitive nerve endings are on the surface of the vulva rather than inside the vagina that contribute to pleasure. So if that's the case, then most intercourse positions actually fail to provide adequate clitoral stimulation, because the clitoris, the glands, the head of the clitoris, is somewhat above the vaginal opening by at least a few centimeters. So that means that most intercourse positions are only intermittently really providing clitoral stimulation. So She Comes First was about sort of shifting from an intercourse-based model to an outer course-based model, and embracing manual stimulation, and particularly oral stimulation. And in speaking about oral stimulation, in my work as a sex therapist, I observed that many women are much more comfortable in terms of their own, what I would call, genital self-esteem or their sexual vulnerability. They're actually more comfortable with intercourse because having a partner that up close and sort of personal with them can be daunting. And again, this is where individual sex scripts come up against cultural sex scripts. A lot of women believe, oh my gosh, that's the ugliest part of my body, not the most beautiful part of my body, or that part of my body smells awful or tastes awful. Men don't really enjoy providing oral sex to women. They just do it because they think women want it, and they're actually, you know, bored by it. So all of those beliefs are myths, and those myths get in the way of couples engaging in more outer course that would really lead to female pleasure. So I've talked to men about, you know, really assuring their partners, like, just as we build up our own sense of self-esteem around our size, our weight, the way we look, the way we dress, a new haircut, you know, we want to build up each other's genital self-esteem. We want to let our, if we're heterosexual, let our female partners know, like, hey, like, I love doing this. It turns me on to turn you on. It gives me pleasure to give you pleasure. And sight, sound, taste, touch, those are all part of the pleasures that I'm receiving. And I'm really happy doing this. In fact, I want to do this. And for many men, it actually removes a kind of pressure that they often feel around their penises and having to perform and maintain erections and last a certain amount of time. So that's a perfect example of where our personal sex scripts also often run up against the cultural sex scripts and get in the way of us actually giving pleasure to each other.
And ultimately, it comes down to communication too. If I can move briefly to the sexual dysfunction that you spoke about there in relation to erectile dysfunction and to premature ejaculation. Now, what I didn't know was that in terms of premature ejaculation, there is an hereditary component. Can that be treated by somebody like yourself, a sex therapist?
Absolutely. You know, many sexual conditions or sexual problems are situational and are psychological and are often are the result of anxiety. And not that early ejaculation can't be amplified by anxiety, but early ejaculation is different in that research shows that it tends to have more of a genetic basis, a neurochemical basis around the balance between serotonin and dopamine in the brain, which is why sometimes antidepressants that raise serotonin levels have the effect of delaying ejaculation and so can be used off-label to help men treat early ejaculation. So there are absolutely ways of treating early ejaculation, but it is a little more challenging than when someone has a more purely psychologically based problem. And early ejaculation is, again, an area where our personal sex scripts fly up against the cultural sex scripts. You know, early ejaculation is not just a young man's problem. It affects men of all ages. You know, men with early ejaculation aren't sexually selfish or narcissistic or immature. They have, you know, a sexual problem that's really only a problem in relationship to giving a female partner pleasure. I can imagine in past millennia when we lived, you know, out in the woods, the jungles, the verandas, and we were having sex with our partners with procreative goals, it's probably pretty healthy to have a quick ejaculation. You know, considering all the threats that are around us, that's a good way of continuing to spread our genes, even if we are going to get killed by a bear and hopefully give our partners time to escape. So in that context, healthy early ejaculation was probably quite healthy and maybe even a sign of health. But certainly when we want to focus on female pleasure and female orgasms, early ejaculation isn't helpful because men very quickly return to a pre-aroused state and lose their erections and lose their sexual interest post-ejaculation. So absolutely can be treated and managed. There isn't a pill like there is for erectile unpredictability, but this is a case where communication is vitally important, and partners have to be sympathetic and empathetic and be willing to explore new ways of pleasuring each other. You know, with early ejaculation, with erectile unpredictability, these are issues that are very challenged when there's a partner who says, hey, the only way I want to have sex is intercourse. That's the real way of having sex. So that's the way I need to have sex. So if you're with a partner who's fairly limited in that respect, or constrained or inflexible, then it's gonna really lead to sexual problems down the road.
We're up against the clock, so I have one final question for you, Dr. Kerner. What advice would you offer listeners who may be hesitant to seek sex therapy or to address their own sexual concerns?
Well, first of all, I would say sex therapy is not psychotherapy. It's not psychoanalysis. In most cases, it can be short-term and solutions-based. Sometimes I only see a couple once or twice or a few times. I often space sessions out by 3 weeks to a month and give homework. And we're moving towards getting to a solution very quickly. So I would say, first off, don't be daunted by sex therapy. But if you don't have access to a sex therapist, or you really won't go, then, you know, first of all, try and get good, accurate information about what you're going through, because so much of what we hear and take in are myths or inaccuracies around sexuality. So get good information and focus on trying to communicate with your partner about what's going on, and to understand that this is a sensitive area and your partner may be vulnerable or may be defensive, but to say, you know, hey, I've been feeling neglected lately a little bit in the area of sex, or I'm missing this aspect of sex, or you know what, I had a sexy dream that we had this kind of foreplay, you know, like whatever it is, try and approach your partner in a way that's sex positive and is relying on accurate information, not just saying like, what's wrong with you? Why can't you get an erection? Go deal with that before you come back.
Well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you today, Dr. Kerner. We're short on time, so I'll let you go there. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Matthew.
Well, thank you for listening to this episode of the Happy Habit Podcast. If you're enjoying this series, if you're getting any value whatsoever, and you would like to support what I'm doing on this podcast, please like, subscribe, share on whatever platform you're listening or consuming the content, and do leave the podcast a positive review. If only that means you giving us a 4 or 5 stars, if we've earned it, well, then please do so. And if you've already done so, well, thank you so much indeed. It really makes all the difference. It helps spread the message of the podcast far and wide. And a reminder, we are also now on YouTube and Instagram. If you want to watch the episodes of this podcast, just search for the Happy Habit Podcast. Until next time, stay happy.